I need to make a confession to you that I have always been very hesitant. Boy, this is a pretty friendly group. That's great. I know what it is. Starved for like-minded companionship. I've always been real uncomfortable talking about some of the things that we might be discussing in this next hour, or 50 minutes or so, rather. I'm not real fond of talking about things like, some of the conspiracy issues that have been floating around for a long time. But there's a conspiracy that's written about in the Bible that we need to take real seriously. And probably if I were giving this message, which I'm not, thankfully, I'd probably call it galloping globalism, because that's what's written about in the Bible. Isaiah 13, Isaiah 17 talks extensively about a coming one-world system, a one-world religion, a one-world government, a one-world primary leader, a false prophet, an antichrist, etc. And so I began adopting 3, 4, 5 years ago an attitude that anything that's leading towards that, I have to take seriously. I have to. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to go off, that you can go off into some extremes. And we have some who, I don't want to say that, you know, the government was behind 9/11, and I'm sorry, but I'm not there and not going to be there. But when we're talking about the issues that the Bible outlines, we have to take it seriously. And that's what Gary Kahn has really specialized in for about 25 years. I followed his ministry for a long, long time. And it also, when we see our country heading towards literal totalitarianism, it's time to take another look at what is behind this. Is there, and I'm going to use a term I have never used publicly. I'm shocking myself. Is there a shadow government? I don't know, but I'm beginning to think there is. What happened today in the news is so shocking. Obviously, you've been watching the news. No, I don't think he's the Antichrist. I think he's the forerunner. And if Gary wants to expound on any of that, I hope he will. But I'm saying these things to lay a groundwork here for what Gary's going to say today and tomorrow. Some of it will be a bit overwhelming to you. I feel he's overwhelmingly accurate. I followed Gary Kahn, as I said, for a long time. He has been my radio guest on many, many occasions. I would have to say that he is one of my audience's favorite guests because they appreciate the sincerity with which he speaks, truth of which he speaks. But we are in a generation where if I bumped into George Orwell, I would apologize and say, I'm sorry I doubted you. We're there. I know we never thought we'd see it in our lifetime. We're there. So we'll talk about some of the issues this weekend that are playing into this whole totalitarianism effort that's going on in our country. We're going to probably give a lot of the inconvenient truth, and more plants might faint back here. I don't know. I guess they're pretty well taken care of. All right. I want to welcome from Indiana, dear friend, Gary Kahn. Come on up, Gary.
Thank you so much. Okay. Thank you, Jan. It's a real honor and a privilege to be here and to have this opportunity to share at your conference this year. I have a great deal of respect and appreciation for Jan and her staff for the strong stand that they take for the Lord, for His truth, and also on the important issues of our times. Very few people are willing to take that kind of a stand, and I applaud her. I don't know how she does it all, but I'm glad we're on the same team. Her staff, cats, and everything, all together. Thank you, Jan. I've actually been in Minnesota quite a few times to speak, especially in the northeast part of the state. But it's been quite a few years since I've been here in the Minneapolis area, so it's especially good to be here today. My wife Audrey and our two youngest children were able to join me on this particular trip due to the fact that our kids' school had its teacher conference this week. So it worked out quite well. So I've put them to work back at the book table. Until a few days ago, they had no idea this is what they'd be doing over their fall break. But it's a blessing to have them here with us. And I hope they feel the same way. I'm sure they do. Our family, along with, I would presume, most of you here this evening, believes that we are living in the last of the last days, and that we will likely be the generation that witnesses the return of Jesus Christ. One of the distinct indicators that we're in the last days is the development of a global system of government that will eventually be used by the Antichrist to enslave mankind and gain his worship. Such a system is foretold and described in Revelation chapters 13 and 14, a prophecy with which this group is already very familiar. I first became aware of developments moving us in this direction more than two decades ago through my job with the government. During the 1980s, I worked as the Europe and Middle East trade specialist for the government of Indiana. In that capacity, I traveled to more than 20 countries working and coordinating trade missions with the staff at our U.S. embassies. My main purpose was to help create more jobs in Indiana by stimulating product exports from our state. Needless to say, I met some very interesting people through my job, both at our embassies and in the international business community. We often spent entire days together, and sometimes they'd even invite me into their homes to be part of their family for an evening. Some of these folks were Christians, but most were not. We had a lot of fascinating conversations about the future direction of the world, and it wasn't long before I realized there was an active movement underway whose goal was to establish a one-world economic and political system. I also discovered that there was a strong religious motivation behind these efforts. This is when I learned about the teachings and inner workings of the New Age interfaith movement. In fact, I was invited to join two organizations that were pushing this one world agenda. I finally left my job, believing God was calling me to write a book documenting my experiences and findings. That book, En Route to Global Occupation, came out in the fall of 1991. Many of you have it. Little did I know that the Lord would use it to launch my wife and I into full-time ministry to talk about this subject matter. During the decades of the 90s, the pieces for a one-world system began to fall into place with increasing momentum. Occult-based groups and foundations were becoming more active and effective and were growing in number. So this is when I released my second book, The New World Religion, which focuses mainly on explaining the spiritual thrust behind the one-world movement, including the occult motivation driving much of the climate change agenda, which is actually a big part of all this. The year 2000 was a coming out celebration for globalists of all backgrounds. And since then, the One World Interfaith Movement has been making very rapid progress. In fact, in order to keep our readers up to date on the latest developments, We had to begin publishing a research newsletter because events were moving forward so quickly. And unless the Lord Himself directly intervenes, I don't expect things to slow down the rest of the way. I would like to make an additional brief comment about our newsletter. For those of you who are interested in receiving our newsletter on a regular basis, it is a paid subscription. And that's because over 200 man-hours go into every issue, and it's quite expensive to produce. We do everything we can to make sure that this is a Christ-honoring publication that is tactfully written and thoroughly documented. So we encourage you to get it and to pass it on to friends. We believe this is something that you would not have to be embarrassed about to give to friends. It may offend them in a certain way, but it speaks the truth in a way that, again, is thoroughly documented. If you subscribe today, we will give you a copy of our most recent issue, and then we will send to you in the mail our fall issue as soon as it comes out in a couple of weeks. I normally like to focus my attention on the spiritual side of things because it is by far the most important in order to be discerning. Religion drives politics, not the other way around. If we understand a person's religious worldview, and I do believe that everybody has one, we will understand where they are coming from and what they will do politically. However, today, because a new administration has taken power and because of the expanding financial crisis we are in, I felt led to speak on our current political and economic situation. So think of the rest of my presentation as a type of State of the Union address, detailing where our nation stands politically and economically with respect to the emerging New World Order. Through the remainder of this year and into the next, several items will continue dominating the headlines. An unstable economy, war, and the pursuit of Mideast peace, the push for unity among the world's religions, and issues of climate change will be nightly themes on the major networks, along with the Obama administration's handling of these matters. At this point, one thing is certain. 2009 will go down as a year of instability and change. And 2010 will likely see an acceleration of these trends. Our new president will continue to receive a great deal of support from the media as he did throughout his campaign and during his first 10 months in office. However, the favor of like-minded liberals alone will not be enough to overcome the monumental challenges he faces. As a Christian, I am praying for Barack Obama, that he will heed God's warnings and make wise decisions in the tumultuous days ahead. But thus far, he has not shown the best discernment in some of his choices. For example, he has appointed mostly pro-world government Washington insiders to his cabinet. They include advocates of bigger government, a socialist agenda, and non-family values. Among President Obama's closest economic advisors are Timothy Geithner and Paul Volcker. Geithner was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and was the Fed's main liaison with Wall Street. He, of course, is now Obama's Treasury Secretary. Paul Volcker is a former chairman of the Federal Reserve. He is Obama's pick to chair the Economic Recovery Advisory Board and was his top financial advisor during the presidential campaign. Volcker is a staunch globalist and supports the introduction of a one-world currency. Both men are favorites of the pro-UN, pro-world government Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR. In fact, Obama's new cabinet is stacked with members of the CFR and their sister organizations, the Trilateral Commission and the secretive Bilderberg Group. Obama himself has shared his geopolitical plans and foreign affairs, the CFR's flagship publication. And his wife, Michelle, is a member of a CFR branch in Chicago. Given these details, we should not be surprised if the president responds to crisis events with steps leading the United States ever closer toward global government. In my book, En Route to Global Occupation, I quoted Rear Admiral Chester Ward, a former member of the CFR. He warned that the one world elite have one objective in common. They want to bring about the surrender of the sovereignty of the national independence of the United States. A second clique of international members of the CFR comprises the Wall Street international bankers and their key agents. Primarily, they want the world banking monopoly from whatever power ends up in the control of global government. The following is a list of Barack Obama's top appointees along with their One World affiliations. You will notice across the tops of their pictures, we've indicated which organizations they belong to. The CFR stands for the Council on Foreign Relations. The Trilateral Commission is symbolized by the three blue arrows pointing inward, and the large red B represents the Bilderberg Group. Now, I'm just going to highlight a few of these individuals. If we take a look at President Obama's top economic and financial advisors, Timothy Geithner, Paul Volcker, and Larry Summers, you will notice that all three of these individuals, the most prominent economic and financial advisors on President Obama's cabinet, are members of all three of these organizations. In fact, Paul Volcker is even the North American chairman of the Trilateral Commission. If we look at the area of national defense and security, Robert Gates, Janet Napolitano, and General James L. Jones are each members of at least one of these organizations. Now, I do realize that it is possible to belong to the Council on Foreign Relations for a period of time without being necessarily a staunch globalist, because sometimes they invite people into their organization in order to try to influence them to go in their direction. The same can be said of the Trilateral Commission and, to a lesser degree, perhaps the Bilderberg Group. However, if you have belonged to one or more of these organizations for several years or longer, and you have never once seriously challenged any of their views or positions, then there is a very high probability that you have come to embrace their worldview, which includes the push for global government. Now, in the case of these individuals I just highlighted, they have all been members of these organizations for many, many years. They are considered to be hardcore globalists. So it is discomforting to see these kinds of individuals on our president's cabinet. If we give President Obama the benefit of the doubt and assume that he is completely naive about the goals of his CFR, Trilateral Commission, and Bilderberg advisors, and that he genuinely has the best interests of America's citizens at heart, he will need the fervent prayers of many Christians to turn this nation's economy around, and not just the economy, but everything else. Consider these economic statistics. Over 250 banks are now on the government's list of troubled financial institutions, up from 117 a year ago. Approximately 100 banks have failed since this January, five during 1 week alone in late August. In 2008, all U.S. car manufacturers saw unprecedented sales declines. Chrysler's vehicle sales were down 30%, GM 23%, and Ford 21% from the previous year. This led, of course, to the bankruptcy this year of Chrysler and GM, which are now owned by Italy's Fiat Corporation and the U.S. government, respectively. All this has taken place in just a few months' time. Incredible. Over 850,000 retail jobs alone have been lost so far in 2009, not to speak of other jobs. By the end of December of this year, more jobs will have been lost in 2009 than any year since the Great Depression. The official U.S. unemployment rate is currently 9.8%. However, the real unemployment rate is 16.8%. And that's because so many people have given up looking for jobs or else have accepted very part-time jobs because they can't find anything else. So they no longer show up on the government's official unemployment statistics. But based on these trends, the nation's official unemployment rate is expected to soar past 10% very soon, and has already done so in numerous states. But there is another problem. It concerns taxation. As a result of the dramatic rise in unemployment, the U.S. government is taking in less and less tax revenue. The government's tax base has dwindled not only because of fewer jobs and a slumping GDP, but also due to the colossal amount of this year's tax write-offs resulting from last year's business and investment losses. This will lead to an estimated record $1.9 trillion deficit, federal deficit, for the calendar year 2009 that will end on December 31st. On January 6th, CNBC posed the question, what do we do if the government goes broke? They acknowledged that we would be in serious trouble very quickly if China suddenly stopped loaning us money because they think we've become an unsafe risk. By the way, our government's AAA bond rating is in jeopardy, which could make it much more difficult to borrow money in the future and also make it more expensive. This, too, may compound the situation. The fact is, foreign powers are increasingly in the driver's seat when it comes to our economic future. Not only is our government dependent on their money to stay afloat, but they are buying up our companies at a record pace. According to a watchdog group called Economy in Crisis, which tracks foreign buyouts of U.S. firms, foreign groups are purchasing an average of $201 million worth of U.S. companies per day. This daily average has been climbing steadily in recent years due to the weakened U.S. dollar, which has made our companies cheap and easy targets for buyouts. As early as the 1980s, U.S. industries were already beginning to succumb to foreign interests. By the year 2000, America was in a crisis, but most Americans didn't know it. The following data, released by the IRS, indicates what percentage of key U.S. industries are owned by foreign entities. Now, mind you, this information is based on 2002 figures, the last year for which industry-wide statistics are available. So imagine what the numbers would be today, 7 years later. They would be substantially higher. I'm just going to focus on a few of these as you study the chart. You'll notice in the area of commodity contracts and trading, 79% of our companies were foreign-owned. In the area of metal ore mining, which affects the state of Minnesota in a major way, 65% of our companies in that area were foreign-owned as of 7 years ago. In the information industry, which includes book publishing, 63% foreign-owned. Engine production, 57%. The one that maybe bothers me the most is coal mining. We are told that coal is our most precious natural resource. Well, 48% of our coal industry was already foreign-owned 7 years ago. I believe today it would be right around 65 to 70%. In fact, I believe that a majority of these industries you are looking at would today be a majority foreign-owned. To get a more current picture, let's consider some recent corporate statistics from the summer of 2008. As of July of that year, the following numbers of U.S. companies had been acquired by foreign entities. Again, these are listed according to industries, but these are actual numbers of companies within those industries that are now foreign-owned. I'll let you take a look at that for a moment. The oil and gas industry, 584 of our companies foreign-owned. Telecommunications, 257 companies. That is such a vital area to our national defense and security. What about commercial banks and bank holding companies? 152 of them are foreknown, including some of those who were directly involved in helping to precipitate the crisis last year. In the food industry and related products, 476 of our companies are now foreign-owned. And some of those companies themselves own 15 or 20 other companies. Most of our farming in this country is now owned by corporate farms. In the area of our utilities, electric, gas, and water distribution, 211 of our companies in that area are foreign-owned. In Indianapolis, where we live, our water company is now managed by Veolia, which is based in Paris, France. I am told that Veolia is now the largest owner of water utilities in the United States. So the French could literally shut off our water if they wanted to. It's unbelievable that our leaders, both Democratic and Republican, have allowed things to get to this point. But they have. And it hasn't taken place overnight. It's taken a while to get to this point. Most of these industries are vital to maintaining our national independence and freedom as a people. Clearly, much of the ability to determine our own future has already been lost, mainly to European interests, which have done most of the acquiring so far. But in the last 5 or 6 years, the Chinese and the Arabs have come in very strong, and they are doing a growing percentage of the purchasing of our companies. It would only be fair to point out, however, that American multinational firms have made their share of acquisitions abroad. You see, the fact is the entire world is being internationalized, and countries are losing their national sovereignty to economic powers that are politically motivated and dedicated to the cause of globalization. So, where do we go from here? Well, unlike previous global financial crises, this time the United States stands to lose the most. Since it is viewed as the primary perpetrator of the still unfolding crisis, it will be expected to give up the most to make things right. Europe's leaders have made clear they expect the U.S. to conform to their wishes. Last November, just days before the G20 summit in Washington, Europe's top officials met in Brussels to lay down the law. At that time, they gave America a 100-day deadline, roughly until the end of February, to agree to their plans. 7 months ago, around the time of that deadline, President Obama met with some of these leaders. After the meeting, he told the press that, and I quote, "globalization is the solution to the economic crisis," end quote. You see, the Europeans want the U.S. to come under the complete authority of a global central bank, and they are applying pressure on Obama to go along with their plans. This was witnessed at April's G20 summit in London, and again last month at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, which really pretty much sealed the deal. Much of what took place in Pittsburgh did not make the mainstream media, but much of our sovereignty, our economic sovereignty, was given away at that summit. And for all practical purposes, a group called the Financial Stability Board now determines the finances of the world, especially of Western society. And I will talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, especially during the Q&A time, because I want to go into some detail on it, and I don't have time this evening. But I'll just say this. There are at least 6 Europeans on that board, only 1 person from the United States. And yet these people are calling the international shots. Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown is publicly spearheading the call for these international reforms. In his annual speech at the Lord Mayor's Banquet on November 10th, Brown remarked, "If we learn from our experience of turning unity of purpose into unity of action, we can together seize this moment of change in our world to create a truly global society." And then to hammer this point home, he restated his position. "My message is that we must be internationalist, not protectionist, interventionist, not neutral, progressive, not reactive, and forward-looking, not frozen by events. We can seize the moment, and in doing so, build a truly global society." As part of Brown's proposal for a new world order, he has called for major reform of the global financial system, including a global trade agreement and an expanded role for the 185-nation International Monetary Fund, the IMF. And again, in Pittsburgh, a lot of strides were made in that direction. Backing him are France and Germany, who are specifically pushing for the IMF to become a global supervisor of regulators, the pivot of a renewed international system, as they call it. On October 12th of last year, the Washington Times had reported that a major shakeup of the IMF should be expected. With China and other Asian markets supplying much of the liquidity that keeps the U.S. economy afloat, analysts say the economic meltdown could signal the rearrangement of the pecking order at institutions like the IMF and World Bank that has been largely unchanged since the end of World War II. Robert Zoellick, the American head of the World Bank, argued explicitly for a larger steering group of countries to replace the long dominance of Western industrial powers at the World Bank and IMF. The G7 is not working, he said. We need a better group for a better time. That same week, then U.S. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson gave a clear signal of the new pecking order on the sidelines of the annual World Bank and IMF meetings in Washington. With world financial markets reeling, Mr. Paulson said he was following up an emergency meeting of finance ministers from the traditional group of seven industrial powers, Britain, France, Canada, Germany, Japan, Italy, and the United States, with a larger gathering of the so-called Group of 20, which includes China, India, Russia, and Brazil. By the way, Russia and China were the first to call for a new global currency to replace the U.S. dollar as the world's main reserve currency. They are now regularly in on the decisions at these G20 summits. You have to understand this. This is a shift, a major shift that has taken place during the last 12 months. On November 3rd, Newsweek gave a not-so-subtle hint of where all these changes are leading us. The title of the article actually said it all. We need a bank of the world. The financial crisis is global, and only an international central bank can deal with it. The author, Jeffrey E. Garton, who is a professor of international trade and finance at Yale University, specified, the IMF could continue to exist, but its board would have to be reconstructed, its bailout role for smaller nations carefully defined, and its directions, including the severity of the conditions it imposes on borrowers, would have to come from the new central bank. To give it legitimacy, a global central bank would have to be governed in light of political realities. That means that its board would include not only the top financial officials of the United States, the UK, the Eurozone, and Japan, but also China, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, South Africa, and perhaps a few others. Garton went on to make his case. He said, it would be hard to overestimate the political pushback that any official proposal for a global central bank would draw from various constituencies, most especially within the United States. Among their many charges, critics will protest the establishment of world government. But we have a World Trade Organization with legally binding powers over trade disputes. We have a World Health Organization for communicable disease with the ability to quarantine entire countries. And a world court functions today that has considerable legal and moral clout. It's true. Most of the elements for world government are already in place. The only thing lacking has been a world crisis or crises to make it all gel. If global problems demand global solutions, as we've been conditioned to believe for the past few decades, then a global financial crisis, a global war on terror, and the much feared effects of global warming give us three good reasons to go along with their solutions. So they would want us to believe. Political columnist Gideon Rachman, writing for the Financial Times on December 8th, summarized, the financial crisis and climate change are pushing national governments towards global solutions, even in countries such as China and the U.S. that are traditionally fierce guardians of national sovereignty. At the moment, unfortunately, It appears that the Obama administration is falling in line with most of the internationalists' demands. And really, they don't have to be very demanding or push him hard because Barack Obama is a globalist through and through. The fact that President Obama attaches great importance to matters of global governance, including the UN, is demonstrated by his appointment of Susan Rice, one of his closest aides and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, as America's ambassador to the UN. He has also given her a seat in his cabinet. Gideon Rackman comments, "A taste of the ideas doing the rounds in Obama circles is offered by a recent report from the Managing Global Insecurity Project, whose small U.S. advisory group includes John Podesta, the man who was heading Mr. Obama's transition team, and Strobe Talbott, the president of the Brookings Institution from which Ms. Rice has emerged. The MGI report argues for the creation of a UN High Commissioner for Counterterrorist Activity, a legally binding climate change agreement negotiated under the auspices of the UN, and the creation of a 50,000-strong UN peacekeeping force. Once countries had pledged troops to this reserve army, the UN would then have first call upon them." Rackman continues, "These are the kind of ideas that get people reaching for their rifles in America's talk radio heartland. Aware of the political sensitivity of its ideas, the MGI report opts for soothing language. It emphasizes the need for American leadership and uses the term responsible sovereignty when calling for international cooperation, rather than the more radical-sounding phrase favored in Europe, shared sovereignty. It also talks about global governance rather than world government. The plan to force America into the New World Order appears to be well thought out. So what happens if Obama doesn't move swiftly enough or fails to get congressional approval to comply with Europe's demands? Here's a potential scenario of what could happen. Europe and its global allies could tighten the screws by ceasing to loan money to the U.S. This would probably force the U.S. government to default within 3 to 6 months from that time. Our companies would become even more vulnerable to foreign takeovers as the U.S. dollar plunges. Our economy would completely crash and unemployment would soar to levels not seen since the Great Depression. We're getting there already now. Unrest and lawlessness would begin to spread as people lose jobs and become desperate. Blame for our desperate situation would be directed, I believe, first at Jews, then Christians, seen as the main obstacles to world peace and financial stability. At our weakest moment, an apparently viable solution would be proposed that promises to keep things from getting worse and to restore peace and stability. This is when a new currency and a regional economic political arrangement might be introduced. They would be part of a broader global arrangement, a new world order with a new kind of leadership that is loyal to its ideals of a one world government, economy, and religious system. Now, I personally believe that as long as President Obama moves in the direction that the internationalists from Europe and elsewhere want him to go in, they will continue to pump a certain amount of money into our economy to help create a softer landing. But if they believe that he's losing a grip and that he's no longer going to be able to do their bidding effectively, I believe at that point they will pull the plug on our economy and stop loaning us most of the money that they are currently making available to us, maybe all of it. And in a very short period of time, things will unravel. So we are facing right now a type of financial blackmail, and it's because we've allowed our country basically to be bought and owned by foreign entities. Resistance to the new order has been mounting among American conservatives. For example, Conservative Caucus Chairman Howard Phillips, WorldNet Daily columnist Jerome Corzi, and activist Phyllis Schlafly are among those who have formed a coalition against the proposed new currency. Some members of Congress are also taking a stand. On January 22nd of 2007, Virgil Goode of Virginia, Walter Jones of North Carolina, Ron Paul of Texas and Tom Tancredo of Colorado were among 43 members of the U.S. House of Representatives who introduced House Resolution 40, a resolution that expressed the sense of Congress that the United States should not engage in the construction of a North American Free Trade Agreement superhighway system or enter into a North American Union with Mexico or Canada. While these noble men and women and many others have drawn attention to the plans of the global elite, they have been unable to significantly slow their progress. We saw what happened and is still happening to Sarah Palin, Ron Paul, Mike Huckabee, and other Christian candidates who have staunchly opposed the New World Order in the past. The internationalist media has done everything in their power to destroy them and make them look utterly foolish, while flagrantly promoting Obama in every creative way possible. Due in part to the growing international crisis, the momentum and money are increasingly on the side of the globalists and their propaganda machine. Unfortunately, I do not see this trend changing. Those who understand what is about to happen and are trying to sound the alarm are in a small minority. Only those who are genuine seekers of the truth realize the full gravity of this moment and are warning their loved ones. So what do we do as a nation and as individuals to get prepared? The U.S. government is now in debt over $12 trillion. If one adds state and municipal debt, along with troubled consumer loans into this mix, the numbers become even more staggering. The U.S. Treasury's GAAP accounting of the federal budget deficit indicated that the negative net worth of the U.S. government in 2008 was $65.5 trillion in total obligations, a sum that exceeds the gross domestic product of the entire world. By the end of this year, that figure could top $70 trillion. The only way America could climb out of the current mess and remain a somewhat free nation is if government spending were immediately cut by about one-third. This would require the complete elimination of numerous government programs, agencies, and departments. In fact, our government, our federal government, would have to go back simply to building bridges, roads, dams, and national defense, and little more than that. If President Obama made such a move, we could be back to normal in 20 to 30 years. That's how long it would take. However, this is unlikely to happen since powerful forces are at work that want to bring our country to its knees. At the risk of sounding too conspiratorial, I honestly believe that the mortgage crisis and last year's high oil prices were engineered to intentionally create the conditions we are currently facing. All that is needed now is a major domestic act of terror or a significant flare-up in Mideast tensions, possibly as an outgrowth of the recent Gaza conflict or new actions by Syria, Iran, or Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the scales would tip. Satan's goal, I believe, is to make our situation appear so hopeless that people around the world, but especially Americans and Israelis, will finally be willing to relinquish their national sovereignty and merge into a global economic political system that promises peace and stability. The prevailing uncertainty is causing normally stable people to be anxious at a level I have not witnessed during my lifetime. Many people are genuinely scared and don't know what to do. They call or write us hoping to receive sound advice. Although my professional background is in economics and international business, I have been hesitant to tell people what to do with their personal finances because everyone's circumstances are so different. Furthermore, I am not a professional financial planner or advisor. However, because so many people have asked, I will give an example of what I personally would do if I had significant money to invest. And I just want to tell you here, I wish I didn't even have to touch on this. I'd rather not. But if I don't, at least a fourth of you would come up afterwards and ask me this question. And that has been my experience, and so I've incorporated it into my presentation. But I will say this, before I go any further, I would tell you, take other people into consideration. Do not make selfish decisions for yourself, or I believe the Lord will not bless it. Do what you do, keeping others in mind, not just yourself. First of all, and most importantly, I would get out of debt, and I would give generously to biblically solid ministries who are speaking the truth. But if I had cash left to invest after doing so, here is what I would do with it. I would keep 5% of my money on hand in the form of cash. This would be for short-term purchases of groceries, gas, and day-to-day items in case a banking holiday is declared, where banks would shut down for a few days or maybe even weeks before introducing a new currency. All other investments would be geared toward offsetting the effects of a currency revaluation that would likely occur if the dollar is replaced with a new regional or global currency. I would plan to remain in such investments until the new currency is introduced and any revaluation of the old U.S. dollar has taken place. This could be several months to several years. After this transition has occurred, some or all of these investments could be traded back in for the new currency. By temporarily putting my dollars into items more likely to hold their value, it would help offset any losses that might occur with the revaluation. For example, if I would eventually be given only one new currency unit for every $5, then it would have been better if I had put my dollars into gold or francs and then sell them off in exchange for the new currency once it comes out. This is how I would invest my remaining 95%. I would put 10% of my money into silver coins that could be used to barter for goods and services. Silver is currently trading at around $17 an ounce, which is getting a bit on the expensive side. Another 25% would be put into a combination of gold and platinum, which should continue to trade in the $900 to $1,000 range for the near future, possibly going significantly higher if the crisis intensifies, which I believe it could in 2010. I would also consider putting 25% into Swiss francs or a combination of other stable foreign currencies. All such purchases would depend to some degree on whether prices are favorable at the time I consider the purchase. Also, the percentages of what I invest in would be conditional on the amount of wealth I have. Someone with $1 million, for example, would invest differently than someone with $10,000. I am basing my scenario on what I would do with $100,000. I would invest the remaining 35% in survival-related items. I'd purchase a few acres of land with available firewood and a fresh spring that could also be used for growing food. Good land would be invaluable if hard times come. Our family has put most of its energy and resources into informing and challenging God's people and is therefore completely at the Lord's mercy. We try to make wise decisions with what we have and trust Him to provide the rest. This is not a bad place to be. Many of you are in the same situation. While Christians should be prudent and plan wisely as God directs, I have noticed these last few months that some believers may be too concerned with their finances and not concerned enough about maturing in their walk with Jesus. Our desire is that everyone would expend at least as much energy pursuing the Lord and His will as they do on financial planning. Any financial decisions should be made only after fervently seeking the Lord's guidance and in accordance with His overall purpose for your life. I cannot emphasize this enough. As we begin to wrap up, there are some remaining questions that need to be asked. They center on the person of Barack Obama. Why is it that the left-leaning, largely interfaith media have been so willing to passionately endorse him? And why is it that so many leaders from Europe, Africa, and elsewhere have referred to him as president of the world, the Savior, or even the new Messiah? Never before have so many messianic terms been used by so many to describe an American political leader. Beginning with Oprah Winfrey, every celebrity New Ager has thrown their weight behind Barack Obama with a seemingly religious fervor. Shouldn't we be wondering why they are supporting him in this fashion? Perhaps Barack Obama is viewed by New Age occultists, interfaith leaders, and political globalists as being the one who can finally deliver America into the New World Order. This is likely to be the case. However, there is another possibility, one that builds on the preceding notion and is being considered by a growing number of Christians not only in America but abroad. What if Obama comes up with unprecedented solutions to the world's problems that seem to gain the support of people everywhere? What if the U.S. economy suddenly turns around, apparently because of his decisive and innovative leadership? And what if he succeeds in securing an enforceable Mideast peace treaty where no one else before him could? It's interesting that today he received the Nobel Peace Prize, basically for doing nothing else but moving us in the direction of globalization and world government. If by some chance Barack Obama were to accomplish these feats and in the process gain the adulation of the world's economic, political, and religious leaders, then beware. Take special note. The Bible indicates in Daniel chapter 11 that the world ruler at the end of time would come to power through smooth talk and flattery and would deceive many, finally unleashing his fury against God's people. Revelation 13 and 14 says much the same. For various reasons, I personally am, at this time, not inclined to believe that Barack Obama is that ruler. We'll have to wait and see. The reason I have chosen to bring this controversy up is because of the way that one world advocates and occult leaders are swooning over, and in some cases practically worshiping this man. I've never seen anything like it. I think you would agree you haven't either. Are the messianic terms used to describe Obama merely insignificant words spoken by exuberant followers, or are they a sign of things to come? I don't know, but I do believe he merits close watching. This would be a good time for all of mankind to remember the admonitions of the Bible. Psalm 146, 3 and 4 says, "Do not put your trust in princes, in mortal men who cannot save. When their spirit departs, they return to the ground. On that very day, their plans come to nothing." The next few years promise to be a difficult period in our nation's history. Regardless of what happens in the U.S. or the rest of the world, this is the time for Christians everywhere to step up and let their light shine. The time for openly and freely sharing the love and truth of Christ, I believe, is very short. We have to make the most of every opportunity. My advice to you, therefore, is stay focused on the cross, first and foremost. Then take a stand and deal with the other issues as God directs you. But don't let the issues, as important as they may be, rob you of your main focus, which should be your relationship and walk with the Lord Jesus Christ. As Christians, we must build the foundation of our lives on the solid rock, not on the sinking sand of this world's interfaith philosophies and vain pursuits. Our goal should be to live productive and victorious lives for our King in spite of difficult circumstances. He has given us His power and Spirit, enabling us to stand firm for Him. God is good and merciful and full of hope for those who seek Him. Even in difficult times when everything seems to be spinning out of control, God is still on the throne reigning over the affairs of men. Nothing happens without His knowledge. Jesus promised that He will never leave us or forsake us, and that He will be with us to the very end of the age. He meant these words. In the days to come, may we never forget the Lord's promises. Let's always be praising Him for His goodness, His grace, and His forgiving love as we boldly face the challenges before us. Let's live the remainder of our lives on this earth as overcomers, as we look forward to Jesus' return and an incredible eternity with Him. Let's pray. Father, we come to You this evening asking for Your help. Help us, Lord, to love You more passionately. Draw us closer to You. Give us strength and special discernment for the days ahead, because we will need it, and we can only get that from You, Lord. Help us to be faithful to You even under the most difficult circumstances, come what may. And may You receive the honor and glory for all good things that take place in our lives as a result of our trust in You. Help us, Lord, to stand firm to the end. We love You, Lord. Thank You. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, Gary. Now, what you just heard was the inconvenient truth. And that's what you hear tomorrow, too.